Welcome to the Zandbergen Report, where wealth strategies and investment wisdom collide, featuring your distinguished host and certified financial planner, Bart Zandbergen.
Welcome to the Zandbergen Report, a showcase for wealth strategies and investment wisdom that's essential for our evolving world. I'm your host, Bart Zandbergen. In studio today, as usual, is our engineer, Paul. Paul, how are you doing today?
I am, and looking forward with great anticipation to today's conversation, because as I sit in this chair, I can't tell you the number of times people come through and drop this term or hint that they know something about it, and yet I don't.
Well, here's the good news. I have who I think is the local expert on the subject.
That's why I think this is great. Yeah.
So with that, I'd like to welcome Nick Rosenthal. Nick, welcome to the show.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Of course. So Nick is a senior vice president with Griffin Capital Securities. He's responsible for raising capital throughout Southern California areas. He's almost 15 years in the business, and he's been both on the deal structure side as well as the capital raising side. And probably one of the most impressive things is I was at a presentation recently where the president of the company was out speaking about our subject today, qualified opportunity zone, and the president continued to defer to Nick, who seemed to be the expert on this subject. So
there you go.
We got the guy.
We got the guy.
So last week, as you recall, Paul and listeners, we talked about a number of year-end tax savings tips. Most of it we refer to as the alphabet or the ABC of tax savings with all of the charitable stuff. And I just did a little bit of a preview of Opportunity Zone and saying that we were going to have something very soon. And sooner turned out later.
And I waited all week.
Totally teased it.
Yeah.
So without further ado, and I actually hate saying that, but I said it anyway.
What is ado? I don't even know what ado is. But
that's why I hate saying it. So, Nick, we're going to get right into it. I know 26 minutes goes by really, really fast, and this is, I think, a fascinating subject. Paul agrees it's a fascinating subject. It's relatively new. So, qualified opportunity zone, can you provide some, let's start with this, Nick, can you provide some background on the legislation and how it came to pass?
Yeah, sure. So, it's really a great story, and it starts with Sean Parker of Napster fame. So, Sean Parker was the founder of Napster, first president of Facebook, and he basically shepherded this legislation to from the beginning all the way through fruition when it became part of the tax code in the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. And really the concept was that he wanted to provide a mechanism where there would be sufficient motivation to drive private sector dollars gains that people were sitting on. Folks like him that had very low basis, maybe had concentrated stock positions like a Facebook, but folks that were philanthropic in nature but also wanted a benefit for that philanthropy. And so how could they create sufficient motivation to drive pent-up capital gains, which are estimated to be about $6 trillion on the balance sheets of American investors, into areas that need tax stimulation to drive investment from the private sector and do good. And this is really what I would call social impact investing on steroids, because mm-hmm. the benefits are so transformative, both to the investors and to the communities that receive those private sector investment dollars. But what was so interesting about this is the initial idea came from a trip that Sean Parker had when he was traveling in Western Africa. And he was looking at sort of the good that private investment was doing in fighting malaria, and basically came up with the concept of, you know, how do we back at home create sufficient motivation for folks that have capital gains to invest in communities and do good? And he got bipartisan support through the process. So a think tank was created called the Economic Innovation Group. Cory Booker, senator from New Jersey, and Tim Scott, senator from South Carolina, both prominent Democrat, prominent Republican, really championed this legislation. And initially what they thought was going to happen was they thought Hillary Clinton was going to become the next president of the United States. So they thought that this tax legislation would happen under a Clinton administration. But the support was so broad from both parties that the new administration under Trump in the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act was able to pass the legislation. So it really came to pass from a combination of both billionaires and politicians getting together and saying, how do we all benefit from driving capital gains that are sitting on investors' balance sheets into what are now known as qualified opportunity zones?
That's a mouthful.
Yeah, and it's a great story. It's a great story about entrepreneurship and politicians getting on the same page to make good things happen.
And
can I ask you something here? Because I'm somewhat of a political junkie here. So you rattled off two prominent senators, one a Democrat, one a Republican.
Yep.
They're both African Americans. Was the assumption made on their part that this would go towards African American communities, Hispanic communities, communities of color, communities in need, or has it been
communities in need? So you know, that brings the question up of kind of what is a qualified opportunity zone.
Let's go there.
Yeah, and a qualified opportunity zone, it really what was in the legislation designed to manifest one of two characteristics. So qualified opportunity zones are census tracts, first and foremost. And these census tracts that were designated as qualified opportunity zones have to manifest one of two characteristics. The poverty rate has to be at least 20% in that census tract, and median household income cannot exceed 80% of the metropolitan area's median household income. So as long as a census tract manifested one of those two characteristics, it was able to qualify as a qualified opportunity zone. Now, the governors of every respective state were empowered to make the designation of which census tracts were opportunity zones. So they looked at the list of census tracts that manifested one of those two characteristics, and they were able to select up to 25% of those and up to 5% of the adjacent census tracts. So if you think about Long Island City as an example, Governor Cuomo in New York really had kind of thought this through. And Long Island City used that 5% rule, or Cuomo used that 5% rule, to designate Long Island City as qualified opportunity zone in an effort to woo Amazon there. Obviously, that trade fell apart for different reasons, but that Long Island City was part of that 5% rule. So essentially, as long as a census tract manifested one of those two characteristics, it was eligible to be characterized or designated as a qualified opportunity zone. That designation stays in place until 2047, and the governors of each state were empowered with the opportunity to select those tracts so that they could facilitate concentrated investment into those census tracts. What they didn't want is to have a very broad list of census tracts that qualified so that private sector dollars went all over the place. What they really wanted was concentrated investment in specific areas to make a difference. And so what we ended up with was 8,700 different qualified opportunity zones. Those zones stay in place. Those census tracts are designated as opportunity zones all the way through 2047. And that is about 12% of all U.S. census tracts. So it's a pretty significant area. And it was really, as you can tell from those two characteristics, one, the poverty rate being at least 20%, and the other, the median household income not exceeding 80% of the metropolitan area's household income, really meant to be directed towards lower income communities across the United States.
But some of them could be adjoining areas?
Correct, yeah, in the path of development, so that governors could use that rule, that 5% rule, to drive private sector investment into the path of development.
So I'll ask one more question, then I'll shut up here. We are in Costa Mesa, across from South Coast Plaza, very affluent area, although Costa Mesa is probably not the most affluent in the community, not Newport Beach or whatever, Irvine. And I'm told there is an opportunity zone here because one of our hosts a show called Accelerate OC here about startups, is opening a new incubator in Costa Mesa in something. How would Costa Mesa qualify? Is it simply because it's next to perhaps Santa Ana, which is the poorest of the areas here?
No, it would the census tract in which they located would have had to manifest one of those two characteristics or be adjacent to, and the governor at the time, who was Jerry Brown, would have had to designate that census tract as an opportunity zone. And what you find, interestingly, is there's parts of other, I would say, areas that have already gone through a transition that are designated as opportunity zones. So if you think about one of the things I said early on, Bart, and this goes to your question, which is the right question. You know, if you think about, you know, when the census data was done last, you know, that these census tracts have to manifest these characteristics. But when that data set, where it came from, when it came from, it was 2010. So we're talking about data that was over 8 years old when these census tracts were designated.
Because they only do census every 10 years.
That's right. Yeah, and the last census in this country was done in 2010.
So there's areas today that are, while deemed qualified opportunity zones, may very well not qualify today.
That's correct. And these census tracts are going to be qualified opportunity zones all the way through 2047. Yeah.
And I just want to clarify something, too, because I think this kind of piggybacks off of Paul's question. Is it an entire city, or can it be an area within a city?
It's an area within
that's
a city.
What I thought.
It's a census tract. And, okay. and wherever,
oh, that's what it, okay.
wherever that line is drawn, you're either in or you're out. So literally, you can have a piece of real estate that is across the street from a census tract, or you can have a piece of real estate that fortuitously is within that boundary, and it just is going to depend on where that census tract line was drawn.
So I know you're going to get into it, but maybe you can give me a quick overview. What do you get when you're in an opportunity zone? What's the attraction?
Paul, why do you do that? Why do you steal my questions?
I'm just trying. I saw it. I'm trying to move it along because we got so many things here. Actually, what it is I'm chomping at the bit to know. That's the truth here.
Your parents didn't teach you patience, did they?
They did not. Not at all.
All right. So I'm going to teach Paul a little patience. We're going to get to that one.
Okay.
No.
So a couple things I just want to clarify because I have these great list of questions and a couple you already hit. I think it's super interesting that it does have bipartisan support. So it's not really a political issue. It's a let's do great thing issue.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's how can we provide sufficient motivation, which is the tax benefits, which Paul wants to hear about, which we'll talk about, to drive dollars into communities and create private sector stimulus.
Yeah. Okay. So I just was messing with Paul. So let's go ahead. I just wanted to mess with
him. I got put in my place hard here. I know.
Okay. So let's talk about, I know everybody's super interested, and I teased it ever so slightly last week, but some of the tax benefits of the legislation.
Yeah. So this, as I mentioned, is what I would call social impact investing on steroids, and this is going to be the steroids part. So as an investor, you can take a capital gain of any kind, short or long, generated from the sale of anything. So piece of real estate, appreciated stock position, a wine collection, an art collection, whatever you would report as a capital gain. And you can defer payment on that capital gain that you realized as long as you invest within 180 days into an opportunity zone or opportunity zone fund. Now, if your capital gain was generated in a pass-through entity like a partnership or a trust that took a distribution, there's some nuances to that 180 days, and that's where someone would probably want to reach out to a CFP like you and talk that through. But generally speaking, it's 180 days from when you realize that capital gain to be invested into an opportunity zone, and only the gain portion qualifies. So if you think about that, and I'll talk about the tax benefits, but it provides an opportunity for an investor to take back their basis in an asset that would otherwise be illiquid because of tax ramifications of liquidating that asset. So you get to take back your basis, do whatever you want with it, but invest that 180 days. And unlike something like a 1031 exchange—
It's just going to go there, the big difference.
You don't have to have dominion over that gain. In the interim period, meaning you can take that capital gain, you can buy a boat, and on day 179, you can invest into an opportunity zone fund. And the capital is fungible. It can come from a source other than what was generated from that gain. What the Treasury wants to see is that you invested within 180 days a dollar amount that is equal to or less than that gain that you realized into an opportunity zone.
And I think that's an important point, too, because I think most investments that have similar characteristics say it's the whole gain, right? You have to roll the whole thing. If it's like
or
a 1031.
Or your basis, like a 1031,
right.
has to go along with it. Here, it's just a gain or a part
a portion
of that gain.
Of,
That's right. Yeah. And so there's tremendous flexibility.
Yeah.
And even if you've already done something else with that gain, as long as you're with your 180-day period, you can take a different source of capital and invest into the opportunity zone and still receive the benefits. So the benefits are you defer paying capital gains in that period up until the end of 2026. So when you pay your 2026 taxes in 2027, you are going to pay on your deferred capital gain.
Can I clarify here? Because
yeah.
I know you're probably going to get to it. And now it's federal, not state. So they still pay state.
It depends what state you're in.
Oh, okay. Good point. I'm speaking of California.
Yeah. Okay. So California is currently not conforming.
Yeah.
It's in Newsom's budget in 2020 to potentially conform depending on the type of an investment that you make. That's not yet in the law. Most states, with the exception of California, North Carolina, and one other that escapes me at present, and you can provide listeners a map. Currently conform, so you can defer if you're in California paying on your federal capital gain until you pay your 2026 taxes in 2027. As long as you have been invested for 7 years prior to the end of 2026, so if you make that investment into an opportunity zone or opportunity zone fund in 2019, you will have been invested for 7 years prior to the end of 2026, you get a 15% step up on your zero basis capital gain that you invested into the fund. Said differently, if I realize $1 million of capital gains in 2019, and I invest into an opportunity zone fund in 2019, I realize no federal capital gains when I pay my 2019 taxes. I'm deferring that capital gain until I pay my taxes in 2027 for 2026, and I'm doing so at 15% lower. So not necessarily a 15% lower rate, but 15% lower amount because I got a 15% step up. So if I realize the gain of $1 million, I'm paying tax on $850,000.
You know what? I'm glad you said that because I have been thinking it's 50% lower rate, but that's not true. It's off of 15% less.
Correct. Yep. Because you get a 15% step up in your zero basis capital gain.
Yeah.
Now, if you haven't been invested for 7 years, so you invest next year or the year after, so you've only been invested for 5 years or less than 7 years prior to the end of 2026, instead of a 15% step up in your zero basis capital gain, you get a 10% step up. So in my previous example, as opposed to paying tax on $1 million of capital gain realized, it becomes $900,000. And the real driver here, although the deferral is nice and the reduction is nice, that's the D and the R, it's really the E. And the E is the elimination of capital gains on the growth of whatever you invest into the opportunity zone.
It's my favorite
fund,
part.
As long as you hold it for 10 years. So if my investment that I make into the opportunity zone grows in value and I sell it after 10 years, I get a full step up in basis in that investment. So if I invested $1 million and my $1 million grows to $2 million, I have just realized $1 million of tax-free growth on my investment. At the federal level, if you're in California, you'll still pay the state on the way out.
Yeah. And that is super, super powerful. The deferral part, when I was early in my career, for those who are old enough to remember Popeye and Wimpy. So Wimpy would say, I will gladly pay you Tuesday for a hamburger today. And I would use that in my examples for encouraging people to use their 401ks. Super simplified, but it's the same thing. The investor now gets to use the money they would have paid to the government, grow it, and then use a portion of that now to pay, in this case, a discounted capital gains. That part is beautiful as well.
And the only thing I don't remember is, what's the magic of 2026?
2026 is when your deferred capital gain is due. So I file a form if I invest into an opportunity zone when I pay my 2019 taxes, assuming I realize the gain that I'm deferring in 2019. And that form says that I am deferring my capital gain. And then I file a form in 2026 saying I am realizing my deferred capital gain. So your deferred gain is due no matter if you invest in 2019 or 2020 or 2021 or after that in 2026. So when you pay your 2027 taxes, excuse me, when you pay your 2026 taxes in 2027.
Yeah.
So that is a hard deadline. The question is, how long have you been invested prior to that, which governs what your reduction is or your step up? So in order to maximize the benefits under the tax legislation, you would be invested for 7 years prior to paying your 2026 taxes in 2027, which means you would want to make, ideally, the investment into the Opportunity Zone to maximize the tax benefits in 2019. Now, the difference between a 15% step up and a 10% step up is somewhat de minimis. You know, if you think about the real return, the real return
driver. He's using Latin again here. He's scaring everybody here.
The real return driver
means a little bit.
is the tax-free growth.
Right.
You know, if you think about being able to invest in something over a 10-year time horizon or longer that grows tax-free, it's pretty phenomenal legislation.
I want to make an important statement because I do have my advisor hat on for sure. And something that I've learned over my many years is a lot of times things from a tax perspective sound great, as this does. But what I have learned is you can't let the tax tail wag the dog, which is the saying we say. And I know you know that, Nick.
Yeah.
So that means the investment itself has to be good as well. Now, you and I are both must comply to compliance. We cannot talk about a specific investment. But can you at least explain what sort of due diligence or what one might look for when they're looking for a qualified opportunity zone investment?
Yeah, and I think that's the critical point here is in the absence of a good underlying investment, the tax benefit overlay is useless.
Absolutely correct.
And so now with a good underlying investment, the tax benefit overlay is phenomenal. So what to look for? I think the first is the experience of the operator. Now, like everything that has tremendous tax benefits, a lot of people run towards it as either a way to receive the benefits personally or to capitalize on other people's desire to receive those benefits. So you have a lot of first-time operators in this space. That's concerning to us as we look at it for a lot of reasons, but primarily because there's a significant compliance apparatus and legal apparatus that you have to wrap around these types of investments to comply to the different rules. So the things that I would be very cognizant of is what is the experience of the sponsor? Have they invested in the types of places, in the types of investments that their fund is going to invest in? Have they thought through the compliance and the legal pieces to putting together a compliant and viable fund? And then, you know, as we think about it, are they investing their own capital alongside of investors, just mm-hmm. like any other investment?
Sure.
I think the other things to be aware of would be, you know, size of the fund. It's challenging to find a lot of really good investment opportunities in these census tracts. Some of them have already gone through transition and they might be desirable. But that leads to a lot of dollars wanting to invest into that space. And, of course, when that happens, the economics become less attractive. And a lot of the folks on the fund management side see this 10-year relationship with their investors as a way to generate long-term fee revenue. So are the underlying investments sound? Have they been well thought through? Is the fund too large to really capitalize on specific investment opportunity? And then the flip side of that becomes, is the fund too small to really be properly diversified? So one of the requirements of investing into an opportunity zone is a substantial improvement requirement. You have to double your basis in your investment inside of 31 months. So if you think about development, you know, if I'm going to build apartments or I'm going to build industrial, you're going to double your basis really easily. And the land is excluded from that calculation. So you really just have to double your basis in the improvements. So development works well, but development is the heavy end of the lift when it comes to real estate investing. So you do want to be diversified, but you want the assets to be identified. So do you take blind pool risk or do you take specific asset risk? There's a happy median somewhere in between.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And all of those things are exactly things that I look for as I'm evaluating, obviously, before I recommend. I think you and I may have both made an assumption, but let's let the audience know what type of development might be done on an opportunity zone?
Yeah, so what we see most fund managers doing is things like apartment development, where there is a need for housing in these communities. I mean, we have a shortage nationally of apartments in the United States. I think the number is we need to build about 344,000 apartments a year between now and 2030 to meet demand. We've only done that one time in the last 30 years, so we see a lot of people building apartments. Apartments tend to be on the more conservative end of the real estate spectrum in terms of recession resilient.
Agreed.
It's needs based more than you know, driven by the economic cycle. So we see a lot of apartments being built. We see redevelopment being done. Redevelopment has some risk, so taking an existing asset and making a substantial improvement. Sometimes in the redevelopment process, you find things that you didn't expect to find. It's easier sometimes to paint a painting with a blank canvas, which is why we see most people gravitating towards development as opposed to redevelopment. But because of the substantial improvement test of doubling your basis inside of 31 months, we see mostly real estate development or real estate redevelopment.
Yeah, this is great.
Could it be a business? Could I just open a restaurant? Can a men's clothing store? Or
It has to be an active business. And so, you know, as we look at that kind of inside of a real estate context, one of the things the Treasury has said is, you know, a net lease as an example, where the landlord really doesn't have to do any active management whatsoever, would not qualify for active business or trade. So it wouldn't be qualified business opportunity. Qualified opportunities on business property. So it can be a business, but there's certain tests that need to be met. And that's why we kind of reiterated in the what to look for is you have to have management that really understands this space and has a compliance protocol with both accounting and legal built around it. Because one of the things we do see is people running towards the opportunity, as you can imagine, starting businesses or buying real estate without those things thought through or in place. And that's a good way to end up in a bad situation as an investor.
Wow. This was a lot of great information. We ripped through 27 minutes, so we've got to close up. Anything else, Nick, closing words that you you want to pass along? Or
no, I enjoyed my time with you both. I think the one thing that we would really stress as you look at this space is consult with professionals and folks that have the infrastructure built to do this. Like we said initially, the tax benefits are great, but in the absence of a compliant and quality investment, you've made a big mistake.
Yeah. All right. In closing up, I usually ask my my guests to explain how people can reach you. Does your compliance allow you to do that?
No, you would actually reach out to someone like you to get in touch with me.
So if anyone has questions on what Nick's had to say today regarding Opportunity Zone or his company, feel free to reach me. Most of you know it by now. It's www.bartzanbergen.com or bart@optivestinc.com. Nick, it was really great. Thank you so much for your time and your generous information. Everyone have a great week, and we look forward to being in studio next week. Cheers.
Tune in next week for the latest edition of the Zanbergen Report, Tuesdays at 2 p.m. Catch up on our recent shows by visiting bartzanbergen.podbean.com. The Zanbergen Report is also available on iTunes, iHeartRadio, and Spotify. Interested in being a featured guest on our show or have a question you'd like to hear us answer? Email podcast@bartzanbergen.com. Bart A. Zanbergen, CFP, and Letitia Burbaum, AIF, are registered investment advisors with Optivest, Inc. and registered representatives with Gramercy Securities, Inc., member FINRA and SIPC. Investment advisory services are offered by Optivest, Inc. under SEC registration.